Can you forgive me? If I've wronged you in any way, will you hold on to the resentment you naturally feel towards me? Or can you let it go? Can you move on? Can you forgive? We ask to be forgiven all the time. At least I do. Maybe I misbehave more than you. But when you think about it, forgiveness is a profound act, a complicated and spiritual act. And when faced with real injustice, whether and how to forgive someone can be a deeply troubling question. Have a listen to these key insights from the new book, Forgiveness, An Alternative Account, by Matthew Ichihashi Potts. Matthew is a professor at the Harvard Divinity School and a minister in the Memorial Church at Harvard University. Here he is.
My name is Matthew Ichihashi Potts, and I'm a professor of religion and literature at Harvard University. I have a new book from Yale University Press entitled Forgiveness, An Alternative Account, and I'm going to share with you five of the key insights from it. Insight number one, forgiveness is a problem. Perhaps the most dramatic public example of forgiveness in recent American memory was in June of 2015, when a white supremacist named Dylan Roof entered the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and murdered 9 church members. After his capture, Roof showed absolutely no repentance. When he was arraigned, however, some, but not all, of the victim's family members offered Roof forgiveness. Observing these public acts of forgiveness during an interview, the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates wondered aloud, "Is that real? I question the realness of that." If forgiveness is real, then it's a real problem. Many philosophers, scholars, and activists have grown skeptical of forgiveness's usefulness in recent years, and for good reason. Isn't it a moral hazard when a person who remains entirely unrepentant and hostile to reparations is offered forgiveness without any condition whatsoever? Why is it so often people of color and those already marginalized by systemic violence who are asked to forgive? Doesn't this transfer the responsibility for repairing wrongdoing from the offender to the victim? I believe these critiques are all valid, but I also believe it's because the form of forgiveness we have inherited, the one that shapes our collective wisdom and our conventional practice, is both very recent and deeply wrong. In fact, there's good evidence that ancient and other models of forgiveness do not necessarily fall into the same traps that our contemporary Western customs do. And to describe these traps, as well as the other possibilities we might find if we explore forgiveness further, I'll move on to my other insights. Insight number two, forgiveness can be angry. Another very public instance of forgiveness happened in 2006, when members of the Amish community of Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania, rallied around the family of Charles Carl Roberts IV, after he had killed 5 young Amish girls and gravely wounded 5 more before committing suicide. The Amish community, including several surviving family members of the victims, mourned with Roberts' mother and widow and even shielded them from the press so that they could grieve in private at Roberts' funeral. This story is fairly well known. What is less well known is how complicated bonds of care and grief developed between Roberts' mother and his victims in the aftermath of the murders. Christ King, whose daughter Rosanna was shot and permanently disabled by Roberts, welcomed Roberts' mother Terry into his home as a part-time caretaker for Rosanna until Terry's death a few years ago. Another child who survived the shooting volunteered to clean Terry's house while Terry underwent chemotherapy. Christ King said in 2016 that even after 10 years of genuine friendship with Terry, of her visiting and caring for his disabled daughter, he still felt anger every single day. We tend to associate the offer of forgiveness with the abatement of anger. To say, "I forgive," often means I'm no longer angry. But this association is not necessary for an offer of forgiveness to be genuine. And when we review our ancient scriptural sources and their references to forgiveness, it becomes quickly obvious that these teachings are far less concerned with how we feel than with what we do. Which makes some sense. Ethics ought to be about evaluating our actions, not policing our emotions. In the early modern period, anger was understood to be entirely consonant with forgiveness and love, rather than contrary to them. The moral philosopher Joseph Butler, for example, in his sermons on forgiveness, spends half his time defending anger, which he calls a natural and necessary emotion. It protects us and others because it helps us know when we have been harmed, and we need to know we are harmed before we can seek redress for that harm. For Butler, forgiveness is not about turning away from anger entirely. It's about reacting to our anger appropriately, without vengeance or hatred. This all makes sense if you think about it. Anyone who has suffered a grievous harm knows that emotions are unpredictable, that anger can arise at any moment. Making forgiveness depend upon the utter absence of anger renders a forgiveness that is impossible to achieve for real victims. This all makes me wonder why, in the last few centuries, we have come so deeply to associate forgiveness with anger's abatement, and I think it's for the reason Butler cites. Anger is evidence of harm. I can promise not to retaliate against you while still being angry with you, and that anger will be a sign my harm has not been redressed and that you still have some work to do. I think in our present moment, we have been left with the form of forgiveness that power wants, the sort that erases the evidence of harm in order to avoid the burdens of reparation. Insight number 3, forgiveness isn't reconciliation. In my book, I spent some time considering the work of the acclaimed scholar and peace builder John Paul Lederach. Lederach is not only one of the founding voices in the field of peace studies, he's also an experienced practitioner, mediator, and negotiator, having conducted peace work in Colombia, Nicaragua, Northern Ireland, Somalia, and many other places. Lederach writes about what he calls the gift of pessimism. When warring peoples have only recently ceased active conflict, he observes, there is often impatience among bureaucrats to move forward with negotiations quickly and towards full reconciliation. But Lederach cautions against moving too fast. In these difficult moments of post-conflict agreement, people are still hurting deeply, and they trust no one, certainly not their enemies, and the peace process perhaps least of all. Lederach says the peace builder must honor this sense of pessimism. Any attempt to pull people too hastily away from their pain and mistrust will be to underestimate and misunderstand the depth of that pain and mistrust. In other words, reconciliation can't be rushed. People have good reasons to mistrust their enemies and to keep their distances. The peace builder's job is to create the space and time for people to process that resentment nonviolently. And often, that may be at a safe enough distance from those they distrust and despise. In our colloquial usage, we often employ the language of forgiveness and reconciliation interchangeably, suggesting that forgiveness requires welcoming an offender back with open arms. But restored relation is, strictly speaking, crucially distinct from forgiveness. Reconciliation can be a good and honorable goal, but it demands certain concessions or actions between parties, which a simple refusal of violence does not. There remains a great deal of moral space between the refusal of vengeful retaliation on the one hand and a fully restored relationship on the other. The assumption that every offer of forgiveness also involves an immediate invitation to renewed intimacy forces victims prematurely to close the gap between their simple retaliatory restraint and the separate, often unwarranted, goal of full reconciliation. There's no reason forgiveness has to rush toward or collapse into reconciliation, and indeed, as Lederach suggests, there are many reasons why it shouldn't. Insight number 4. Forgiveness seeks justice. One of the most ancient frameworks for justice that we have comes from the Hebrew Scriptures, though it has analogs in both ancient Babylonian and Roman law. It's called the Lex Talionis, which is Latin for the law of like for like. And you probably know it, even if the Latin name isn't a familiar one to you. It comes from Exodus 23. If any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. This sense of justice is so deeply ingrained that we don't even notice it. It's just what justice is. When a wrong goes unpunished, we feel that justice has not been done. But what's really at stake in the ancient law of like for like? First of all, it's important to note that retaliation doesn't actually restore anything. I can't put your tooth in my mouth if you knock mine out. So if it's not about literal compensation, what is it about? First of all, it's about restraint. You're not entitled to murder someone who sprains your ankle. It's only a tooth for a tooth, only an eye for an eye. One should also consider that this law was written at a time when social status entitled the powerful to all sorts of abuses toward the vulnerable. What this teaching also suggests, then, is the idea of equal dignity, that a poor man's tooth is worth no more or less than a powerful man's. Justice isn't about payback. It's about respecting the equal dignity of enemies. In other words, what is at stake in this law is something about ensuring fairness and promoting restraint. What it's not about is any sort of fantasy of compensation. In fact, there is little evidence that teeth were ever actually pulled or eyes plucked out as a general rule of punishment in ancient Israel. Instead, monetary fines were levied as equivalent compensation for lost eyes and lost teeth, but this has led to a problematic conceptual legacy. Think how pervasively an economic metaphor structures our language about punishment. We say offenders must be redeemed, like vouchers. We say that people emerging out of incarceration have paid their debt to society. But what does that even mean? How is 5 years in prison anything like drug possession? Is this like for like? In the cases of the most grievous wrongs, of course, no compensation is possible. And the idea that vengeance can provide some sort of compensation is a form of culturally persistent magical thinking that betrays the basic values of the lex talionis. If you take $5 from me, you can give $5 back, with interest even, depending on how we define repayment. But if you kill my brother, no act can restore what has been lost. The loss is something I must find a way to live with, not something I can demand you find a way to recover. Justice is about finding a way for a community to move forward in the wake of harm. And in the wake of irrevocable harm, forgiveness is just the sort of justice. It is always a form of judgment, because it names and condemns wrongdoing by implication, since you can't forgive rights, you only forgive wrongs. But in levying its judgment, forgiveness commits to the values of restraint and equal dignity that ground the lex But in levying its judgment, forgiveness commits to the values of restraint and equal dignity that ground the lex talionis in theory, if not in practice, and in spirit, if not in letter. Insight number 5. Forgiveness is mourning. Near the end of Homer's ancient epic war poem, the Iliad, there is a brief truce between the Greeks and the Trojans, who have been battling one another for the whole of the poem. Through thousands of lines of verse, the Greek warrior, Achilles, has been terrorizing the Trojans, and he has laid waste to the Trojans' hero, Hector, leaving Hector's beaten, broken corpse unburied and unmourned on the battlefield in response. In response, Hector's father, the Trojan king Priam, comes to Achilles to beg the body of his son. The old king falls at the feet of Achilles and weeps. Achilles gazes upon his aged enemy and recalls his own dead father Peleus and his dead lover Patroclus. And then Achilles, the man of rage, weeps too. Priam and Achilles cry together, and then they sit for a meal together and admire one another's awful beauty. Achilles returns Hector's body to Priam to be buried according to the proper rites, and the armies have peace just long enough to mourn their dead. This ancient story exemplifies why I characterize forgiveness as a form of mourning. Forgiveness accepts that what has been lost cannot be restored, and then it aims to live in and with the irrevocability of wrong. If forgiveness is a moral good, then it is good only in the sense that mourning is a social or psychological good, not because mourning itself is a wonderful and enjoyable thing, but because it is the way we learn to struggle with and through and in a loss we cannot redeem. On this account, forgiveness is more tragedy than triumph, less miracle than mourning. Since forgiveness addresses the past so unflinchingly, it also positions itself more honestly toward whatever future can actually come to be. The urge to live with loss is still an urge to live, and so forgiveness will be, even if only reluctantly, a stance of openness toward the future. It is a future some parts of which we may dread, a future which might demand that we daily face down sorrow, anger, and anguish. But just as the realism of mourning involves the acceptance of a future bereft of one's beloved, forgiveness's refusal to reciprocate its wrong imagines what a wronged life lived well could be. It does not vainly try by violence to rectify an irrevocable wrong. Rather, forgiveness looks with grief towards what life really must become going forward, and then it faces that future with a grim will and survives. So these are 5 of my insights on forgiveness. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the book.
Thank you, Matthew. That was Matthew Ichihashi Potts with 5 big ideas from Forgiveness, an Alternative Account. You might also enjoy our book bite for No Cure for Being Human and Other Truths I Need to Hear by Kate Bowler. I'm Rufus Griscom. Have a great day.